Court, Mr. James Holt, will present arguments for the petition.
May it please the Court, I'm James Holt. I'm the representative of Richard Winters, and I'm with the law firm of Holtz & Wright in Houston, Texas. Mr. Winters is here today asking this Court to extend the public policy exception to the employment at will doctrine that it recognized in the Sabine Pilot decision, which was rendered by this Court back in 1985. In Sabine Pilot, this Court recognized that the public policy, as expressed in the laws of this state and in the United States, which carry criminal penalties, requires a very narrow exception to the employment at will doctrine, and that narrow exception being to cover only the discharge of an employee for the sole reason that the employee refuses to perform an illegal act. The issue before this Court today is whether or not the allegations by Mr. Winters that he was discharged for reporting illegal activity should also state a cause of action. We're asking that this public policy exception be extended to cover not only employees who report illegal who refuse to commit crimes, but also to those who in good faith report criminal activity to their employer. We feel that the public policy, as expressed by the laws of this state and the United States, which carry criminal penalties, would basically cover both causes of action. We believe that public policy, as expressed through these statutes, clearly promulgate the eradication of criminal activity in the workplace and elsewhere, and would encourage the reporting of crimes and the prosecution of those responsible.
Let me ask you about that, sir. You do refer to the statute the Texas legislature passed. If your client had been working for the Daily Texan out here at the University of Texas instead of the Houston Chronicle, he would not have a cause of action under that statute, would he?
The Daily Texan?
If he were a public employee, I'm just using that as an illustration, he would not have a cause of action.
No, he would not.
Under the statute that's been passed here in Texas.
That's correct.
Because he's not a whistleblower in the sense of having reported this conduct to any third party, any law enforcement agency.
That's correct. That would have been the problem with regard to Mr. Winters' case if he had been a public employee.
Isn't there a difference between a whistleblower and a complainer? Somebody who just complains to their own employer?
Well, the respondent has made that argument, and the difference being that a whistleblower is trying to expose criminal activity. A complainer is not necessarily exposing anything other than complaining about possibly what he perceives as being an unfair practice. I think there's a major distinction there, and I think the public policy exception that I'm asking this Court to promulgate should make the distinction between activity which is criminal in nature and would violate a statute that is criminal in nature, and one that simply is not criminal but is simply an internal grievance within a company. And we don't have that situation here. What we have is the allegations by Mr. Winters that there was massive circulation fraud going on by the Houston Chronicle. And what's the problem with that? It's the fraud, in effect...
Would you define massive for me? Because I don't see anything in your brief that refers to massive circulation fraud.
In our First Amendment petition, Your Honor, we cite you one example of where I believe there was approximately, the allegation was that there were approximately 12,000 subscribers. Well, in effect, Mr. Winters discovered there were only approximately 500 in that situation.
It may be an ethical conduct, but can you tell me what evidence you have of any illegality or any illegal acts?
Well, definitely. What the problem with the circulation fraud is the fact that these figures are used and reported as being their paid circulation figures. Advertisers who are determining how to spend their advertising dollars of revenue will look at these figures and trying to determine what's the best way of reaching the most people. And if the Houston Chronicle does not have the circulation figures that they're claiming they do, then there's a deception and a defrauding of the advertiser. In other words, they're offering a service that they're not providing.
What law are they violating? What penal statute are they violating?
In that situation, it would fall under the deceptive business practice as being a material misrepresentation in an advertisement regarding something that they're not providing.
What is the total circulation daily of the chronicle?
At that point in time, it was approximately 380,000.
So even using your numbers, it's a de minimis percentage, is it not?
Well, that was just one example. We actually believe it was about 75,000 to 85,000 in fake circulation each day that was being claimed by the firm.
Is there anything in the record that says that is?
No, Your Honor.
I noticed that your client seems to have a propensity for being transferred. I count approximately 7 departments that he was transferred one to the other, and it appears that he was having problems with all of his supervisors. Did he get along with any of them?
Well, we feel that certainly I believe he did. I think the problem was the fact that he was being retaliated against. When he first approached the first time that he was retaliated against was when he went in and reported the circulation fraud that he discovered to his immediate supervisor. Shortly thereafter, because he was not considered to be a team player or willing to acquiesce or be involved in the fraud that was going on, he was transferred out of that department.
But why wasn't he fired at the beginning? Why did they keep him for 6 years?
Well, there's a distinction that has to be made between certain types of corporations and companies. For one thing, I don't believe that the Houston Chronicle, being a fairly large corporation, has its own personnel department. It has its own policies and procedures that have to be followed. Moreover, Mr. Winters had some connections within the Chronicle, which I think somewhat protected him. So I think the only types of retaliation that were initially directed against him were simply to get him out of the way.
Mr. Holmes, do you have any cases where anyone was ever prosecuted criminally for overstating newspaper circulation figures?
No, I do not, Your Honor.
Isn't it probably true that if the district attorney started prosecuting that, would close down all the newspapers in the country?
Well, I would certainly hope that it's not that widespread.
Does it make any difference how serious the offense is? For example, if an employee came back from lunch every day and reported that 5 of his fellow employees regularly jaywalked on the way to lunch, would that fall within your exception?
Well,
as opposed to murder or something much more serious.
There may be some type of logical place where the individual might draw the line. However, I'd like to point out that let's look at what this public policy exception that I'm asking, what would it promulgate? In my opinion, all that's going to happen is that it's going to eradicate criminal activity in the workplace, or at least help do so, through encouragement of reporting of illegal activity.
But you would ask for an exception that applies to any criminal activity?
I think that any serious criminal activity that would violate the laws of this state. I think society has promulgated these statutes to let individuals know what society is willing to tolerate and what they're not willing to tolerate. If you look at the commentary behind the Deceptive Business Practices section of the Penal Code, it states, in effect, that the reason for this is to stop businesses and protect, or stop businesses from cheating and protect the customers. Well, in this situation, the customers were the advertiser, and in effect, they were not getting what they were paying for. In effect, were being defrauded, along with the general public as a whole. Anyone who would use those circulation figures in deciding to advertise with the Houston Chronicle was being deceived and defrauded.
But he's never made complaint to anyone outside of the Chronicle about that?
No, he went internally within the Chronicle, initially to his immediate supervisor. Then when he discovered, when he was transferred out of that section into another division and discovered that the fraud was more massive than originally thought, he went to the circulation director of the Chronicle and reported it to him. At that stage, again, he's retaliated against. He's moved out of that division and put off in a warehouse somewhere where he's no longer involved in the day-to-day operations of the circulation department.
So the new line you would have us draw is broader than complaining to third persons about criminal conduct or committing criminal conduct. You want it to apply to complaints about any type of criminal conduct to the employer.
Yes, I think the employer should have the opportunity. It should be actually be the first one that is notified of it, because I think the employer is in the best position to put an immediate stop to the criminal activity that's occurring within his workplace. And then he can make a decision as to whether or not to pursue prosecution of the individuals that are involved.
If this is illegal, does not the employee, after some period of time, have a responsibility to notify the authorities? And is not waiting 6 years rather strange?
Well, I think there may be some logic to that argument. I think you also need to look at what the employer, the perception the employee has. He has no protection at the present time. And I would assume that if Mr. Winters had gone to law enforcement officials at that point in time, he probably would have been immediately terminated. At the present time,
there's a difference between allegations of criminal conduct and proof of criminal conduct. Are we dealing here with allegations?
Well, we feel we will be able
to. Mr. Winters made certain allegations. Did he present proof of these matters when he made the complaint?
I believe, to be honest, I believe that he simply went in and informed his supervisors as to the investigation he had conducted and what he had discovered. Whether or not he took in figures and showed them, I do not know at this point in time. I would simply state, however, that the allegation of criminal conduct, I think, is sufficient.
We're not dealing with hearsay. He's not going in and telling a supervisor that he heard that such and such was going on.
No, what he had done is gone out to ask the individuals to supply him with the names of the subscribers. They can't do that. He finds out that these individuals are carrying all these excess papers and are simply hauling them down to the dump or disposing of them in some manner.
And he verified that? That's what happened?
Yes. And he reports that to a supervisor.
That they couldn't produce the names and that they were, in fact, destroying the papers?
In fact, all they could produce was approximately 500 names for the 12,000 papers that they were receiving.
You suggest in your brief that we adopt the attitude expressed by Justice Levy in several dissents concerning an implied covenant of good faith and fair dealing in employment contracts?
I had mentioned that. I know this court has declined to rule on that issue in the McClendon decision, and I'm not asking the court to do that today. I think simply recognizing a slight broadening of the current public policy exception to cover an employee who reports illegal activity and does so in good faith. Mr. Winters, I'd like the court to understand, what did he have to gain from going to his supervisors and reporting this? Nothing. He had absolutely nothing to gain. It was nothing he was doing as a personal benefit. His concern was simply he saw something that he perceived as being criminal in nature, that people were being defrauded by the Houston Chronicle. And he simply went ahead and reported this activity. And as a result, he ends up being retaliated against by a supervisor, being transferred around by the Houston Chronicle, finally being demoted, and then ultimately terminated. And he's terminated after he goes to outside of the circulation department to the Chronicle's upper management, the personnel director, and reports this.
Is this judgment essentially on the pleadings?
Yes, it is. We have not had the opportunity to establish in a trial any proof of the matter as yet.
The factual statements that you've made in response to several questions here, are those from allegations in the pleadings or the summary judgment record, or are they outside the record?
Mr. Winters has filed an affidavit in our response to the summary judgment motion, and that affidavit is uncontroverted, and all of this is contained in that affidavit.
Are there not some individuals who are simply perpetual malcontents?
I certainly would agree with you, there are. I do not believe Mr. Winters is one of those individuals, however. In other words, Mr. Winters worked for the Houston Chronicle from 1977 through 1986 for over 9 years. And I think if he'd been a chronic complainer, they would have gotten rid of him much sooner than they did.
But you said he had friends at high places who protected him.
Well, yes he did. And that's what made it more difficult for his supervisors, immediate supervisors, and the individuals in the circulation department, I think, to get rid of him as quickly as they would have liked to.
But in looking at the list of departments to which he was transferred to other departments that had nothing to do with circulation, and yet they in turn would transfer him.
Well, I don't know if that's internal decisions by the corporation. There's no indication that there was any problems that he was having whatsoever. In his affidavit, he states that he had no problems. As far as we're concerned, he was never informed of any problems that the Chronicle was proceeding with his job performance or his work, or with problems he was having with his supervisors. His problem was the fact that he came ahead forward and reported what the Chronicle didn't want to hear. And that was that the circulation fraud was going on. The circulation department didn't want to do anything about it, and in fact, we believe encouraged it through their policies and procedures.
You said in your amended pleadings you made allegations that approximately 20% of the, you said...
No, that's not contained 70, in the... 75,000 to 85,000 is what we have discovered, but that is not contained in the record.
Okay. That's in your plea.
No, it's not even in the pleadings.
And there's no proof of it whatsoever?
No, the only thing we have alleged is the fact that on that one instance, the circulation fraud of approximately 11,500 papers.
Are these the papers that were being put into the racks and so?
No. This is a separate matter. These are papers, excess papers, that are simply being hauled away, disposed of in some other manner.
If an employee is a perpetual malcontent, just a complainer, a know-it-all, even if his judgment about some decisions is more in the interest of the stockholders in the company than the management's decisions are, but he is not reporting to his superiors any criminal conduct, the employer, under your slightly broadened public policy exception, would retain the right to dismiss that employee without cause.
I believe so. I believe that was the situation, for example, in Gary versus the United States Steel Company, which is cited. And I think that distinction certainly can be made by this court and has been made by other courts. In this situation, however, we feel that the conduct of the Houston Chronicle was criminal in nature.
Well, the concern I have is whether that's a sufficient bright line test if the employee does not then proceed to tell any law enforcement or governmental agency about it. I suppose that you basically require the person to whom the complaint is made before they dismiss the employee to determine with their lawyer whether there's been any violation of a criminal statute or just gross negligence, or how do you establish a test that an employer operating in good faith can instruct its middle-level management people to follow?
Well, I think, for example, anyone who reports any type of problem that they perceive as a problem within a company, if it's being done in good faith and they're reporting it to their immediate supervisor, for example, you would expect that if that individual is if he feels there is a problem at least, will sit down and look into it, or will send it up the chain of command and ask, so to speak, for some type of guidance in the area. You don't expect for the individual who's reporting this in good faith to be terminated. And when it involves criminal activity, then I think you've stepped over the boundaries of what is and of what is considered as being possibly at least within the jurisdiction and under the discretion of the employer, into in effect attacking what public policy is prohibiting. And that should be, public policy should be encouraging reporting of criminal activity. Palmer versus Brown, which is the Kansas Supreme Court decision of 1988, which is cited in my brief, they specifically come out and state that. They find that the public policy of the state of Kansas is to encourage employees to report criminal activity.
Any other questions? Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
Before we hear arguments from this time.
May it please the court, Mr. William Ogden and Mr. James Snell will present arguments for the respondent, Mr. Ogden.
May it please the court, my name is Bill Ogden. Together with James Snell, I represent Respondent, Houston Chronicle Publishing Company.
We ask the court to affirm the judgments below. I would like to speak to six distinctions that I feel distinguish this case from other jurisdictions which have recognized a tort claim for retaliatory discharge for private employees engaging in whistleblowing. Mr. Snell, in the balance of the time, will discuss 26 states which have legislated in this area and distinctions between those state statutes and Mr. Winter's claim. But first, I need to bring to the court's attention one case not in the brief, which should be in the brief. I think if followed, it would dispose of this case. It's the 1982 decision of the Austin Court of Appeals in Mouse, M-A-U-S, versus Living Centers, Inc., 633 Southwestern 2nd, 674. Writ refused NRE, 633 Southwest 2nd, 674. Mouse was a nursing home nurse's aide, a private employee who reported internally to her superiors that there was patient neglect and patient abuse at her nursing home. She was fired immediately in retaliation for those internal complaints. The statute, there was a statute that Mouse could point to which specifically spoke to the misconduct which was the subject of her whistleblowing, namely Article 4442C, Section 16 of the Vernon Statutes, said that nursing home employers and employees had a duty to report patient neglect and patient abuse to the state licensing agency, and it's a Class A misdemeanor if you don't report it. There was, I submit, a stronger public policy at work in Mouse. The proof in that case showed one patient was neglected and died. Despite that proof and despite that specific statute, Mouse, an internal whistleblower, was denied relief against her employer for retaliatory discharge in summary judgment. The summary judgment was affirmed by the Austin Court of Appeals, writ refused NRE by this court.
That's the position that you're advocating here today.
I'm advocating a position slightly softer than that because I do not believe that in this case there is the clear and convincing specific proof of a criminal act. I think the best that Winter's petition gets him is a management dispute. He counts papers differently than his supervisors count papers. He and his management have a disagreement over how you account for the number of papers in the AM circulation division, and that's it. Mouse had a stronger case. Mouse had a specific statute, and Mouse had a human being who died, and there was a stronger public policy at work in that case, and still no cause of action recognized for retaliatory discharge.
So you have no problem with our defining the public policy exception, expanding it from Sabine Pilots to include Mouse?
Well, I wouldn't be real comfortable with it.
In fact, one of your amicus, one of the amicus briefs that's been filed in support of your position takes the position that it's all right to dismiss employees who report the commission of a felony. Is that your position?
I think you've got a stronger case. But my position is not quite that, because I believe that whistleblowing should be left to employees who'd make a good faith effort, who do it quickly, and who report it in writing to an appropriate law enforcement authority. I would not like to see the court recognize an exception for private employees that goes beyond the state statute for public employees.
So the elements would be good faith,
promptness,
in writing. And to a third party.
To a third party, clear and convincing proof of a criminal act. And I think in the cases I'm about to discuss, you'll see those are the predominant elements where the tort is recognized elsewhere. Six distinctions between Winter's case and the cases in other jurisdictions that recognize this tort. In the first place, most jurisdictions require that it be a public employee. In the second case, most require that the employee make an external report and usually a report in writing. That specifies the criminal charge. By external report, I mean a report to a law enforcement agency or an independent regulatory authority of some type. Usually the complaint is in writing so that it's clear what is the misconduct that's the subject of the employee's charge, and everybody can be on the same page about what's the complaint. Third distinction, usually the plaintiff is fired immediately after he makes his complaint or her complaint. In this case, recall that Winters made his first effort at what he calls whistleblowing in October of 1980. He was given seven opportunities in different departments to try to get along with somebody, and he wasn't terminated until June of 1986.
So when you indicated that promptness was an element, you're talking about immediacy of retaliatory action, not the promptness of which the employee exercises in reporting the criminal event.
I think there should be both, because if the event is sufficiently serious to affect the public interest and to require that the court disrupt the employer-employee relationship, then it's something that the employee ought to bring to the attention of a law enforcement authority immediately, and it's something that, for proof of the true retaliatory nature of the discharge, you should see an immediate adverse effect on the employee before you recognize the tort. There should be a quick time frame. Realize that the reason for this is because when this concept was first recognized, the remedy for public employees in most cases is reinstatement. Well, if you wait 6 years to make your complaint and 2 years to bring your lawsuit, reinstatement is in many cases not a feasible alternative. So prompt action was a necessary component of the thinking when this tort was first created. A fourth distinction, often there's a finding that the whistleblower himself was at personal risk of prosecution or censure. Good example in the plaintiff's application at page 15, Coleman versus Grand Union. Coleman was the pharmacist in New Jersey who reported his employer's violations to the State Board of Pharmacy on July the 4th, external report. He was fired July the 5th, immediate retaliation. The court noted at page 730 that Coleman's failure to report could, quote, expose him to the risk of suspension or revocation of his license. Fifth key distinction, when other courts have found a public policy exception, usually the whistleblowing plaintiff has, and this is the most important, I think, clear and convincing proof that a specific statute germane to his employer's business has been violated. Example, Harless versus First National Bank in the petitioner's application at page 14. The plaintiff was a bank vice president. He had 12 customer files he pulled from the trash cans, which he could show contained violations of the West Virginia Consumer Credit Code, the business of his employer, the bank. They were usury violations. Now, when this court has recognized past exceptions to employment at will, it has operated in precisely this spirit. McClendon versus Ingersoll Rand. There's a statute which speaks to the reason for disrupting the relationship. That's the federal ERISA statute. The public policy, protection of the integrity of pension funds. Sabine Pilot versus Houck. There's statutes which speak to environmental laws. Indeed, the Coast Guard regulations were posted where Houck had to discharge his bilge water. This does not present that kind of a case. Petitioner cannot point to a specific statute related to advertising by newspapers or circulation, what he, I think, gratuitously calls circulation fraud. He says the misconduct may violate, permissive voice, his word, may violate the Civil Deceptive Trade Practices Act. And he says there is a rumored kickback offer. Notice it never happened, but it was an offer of a kickback, which, had it happened, would have violated the general criminal attempt statute or the general provisions on theft. That is not the type of statutory specificity which other jurisdictions have recognized would give rise to an exception to employment at will. Sixth and critical difference, the misconduct which is exposed by the whistleblower and which is prescribed by a specific law usually must have a direct impact on public health, public safety, and public order. Where a whistleblower points out that food is mislabeled in violation of the Connecticut Food, Drug, and Cosmetic Act, where a whistleblower points out that contaminated milk is being sold in violation of the California public health laws, where a whistleblower points out that a drug is being tested with 40 times the level of saccharin safe for human consumption, there are obvious and material impacts on public health and public interest that may warrant a disruption of employment at will. Not in this case. At the application on page 15, I think the test was well articulated, Palmateer versus International Harvester, and I quote, a survey of cases in other states involving retaliatory discharges shows that a matter must strike at the heart of the citizen's social rights, duties, and responsibilities before the tort will be allowed.
Well, let's suppose it strikes at the heart then, and you've got these five, six, or seven elements. You're not really objecting to a broadened exception to the employment at will doctrine You just don't think that it should be broad enough to include this case?
That's correct. I think a good enunciation, probably the fairest enunciation, which Mr. Snell will discuss, is the Kansas case of Palmer versus Brown. You can recognize the tort and decide that it does not apply on these facts. There can be a material criminal violation which can be reported internally. Now, so I'm clear, I personally, the respondent's position is you shouldn't recognize it without objective reports in writing made quickly to external law enforcement authorities.
You've obviously done a thorough job of studying the laws in other states on this subject. How many have recognized a cause of action of some type for whistleblowing or the report of criminal conduct by the courts are doing it rather than the legislature doing it?
I believe there are 8 or 9. Mr. Snell can speak more directly to the statutes. But
what type of damages have been allowed in those 8 or 9 jurisdictions?
It runs the gamut. In some cases, they allow tort damages. In some cases, they limit it to purely contract claims. There's some of both. Illinois, I believe, or Indiana, limits it to contract claims, and other cases have allowed tort-type damages. But all of the cases, I think both sides have found all of the cases where the tort has ever been recognized, and I believe representative samples from all the jurisdictions are in both of the briefs.
Apart from the employment at will doctrine, what justification is there for terminating an employee solely because he reports the criminal activity of another employee?
Right of the employer and management to maintain order in their own house.
I mean, other than the employment at will doctrine, wouldn't the employer be better off knowing?
Absolutely. Absolutely. And had there been legitimate criminal activity, I think any conscientious employer would want to know about it and should be encouraged to take steps to correct it. But that's a difference from unfounded rumor mongering.
So if someone had been stealing from the company, from the newspaper, and he reported it and got fired, that would be a different situation.
It would depend on, it could be, it would depend on who he reported it to and what they were stealing. Whether there should be an exception recognized because somebody takes an eraser out of the office supply room, I think there can be trivial instances which are technical criminal violations. I think to justify a disruption of the employer-employee relationship, it should be something that strikes at the heart of the citizen's duties and responsibilities. It should be of a larger magnitude.
He lists one of his examples, that the plastic bags that are put over newspapers when they're wet, that he was offered a of $1 per container of plastic bags. Now, would that not strike at the heart?
Well, I don't think so, because look at the pleading and give him his best due. He says that was discussed and offered. He never says that that happened.
Well, is an employee supposed to participate in a criminal act?
No, sir. Absolutely not.
Okay. Well, if he turned it down, how could it ever have come to fruition?
Well, as I understood his pleading, he was invited by this supervisor, Satterfield, with whom he said he had a run-in several years earlier, to participate in this scheme, and he declined the opportunity to do so. Had he reported that to, for instance, he mentions there's an Audit Bureau of Circulations. Had he reported that to the Audit Bureau of Circulations? Had he reported it to the police? Had he reported it to anybody? And had there been a good faith external investigation, I think his case would be much better. I think in this case you have a management dispute.
Your time is about to expire, Ken.
I know. I need to leave some time for Mr. Snell, if I may.
Let me ask you. You said that there's a difference in the way he counted papers and the way his supervisors counted papers. I don't quite understand. What are you saying there?
Well, his allegation, I think, and again, this is an amended petition following special exceptions. So the allegation was, at its most specific, was that he, in the business AM division, sometime back in 1980 or 81, he himself could only verify 500 addresses, and he says the employees were reporting 12,000 paid circulation. I think it's a permissible inference from that there's simply some disagreement as to how you count. We don't know whether he got all the information. We don't know whether he had all of the addresses or not. But give him his due. You have to take his pleading in the light most favorable to him. So you've got an 11,000 paper dispute over what the circulation could have been 6 years before he was fired. I don't think that is of the magnitude. I don't think it's a clear criminal violation of any statute of this state, and I don't think it's of the magnitude that justifies a statewide exception to employment at will.
You want to leave your co-counsel some time?
I would love to, if I may be excused at this time, and let Mr. Snell address the statutes.
May it please the court, Mr. Snell will continue to argue.
May it please the court. The 3 or 4 minutes that I have left here, I want to direct the court's attention to an analysis that we have performed for the court of the 26 state whistleblower statutes that exist right now, and I believe that that is in front of all the justices. The clerk assured me it would be. I think the first thing that is very clear from looking at these statutes is that the states which have legislated in this area have placed some rather severe limitations on the protection of whistleblowers, whether they be in the public or the private sector. But I think maybe the fastest way to analyze this is simply mathematically. Of the 26 states that are analyzed here, only 10 of those states protect private employees at all. 16, like Texas, would only extend whistleblower protection to those who work in public service. 7 of those 10 would create a private cause of action, and 6 of those 7 have short limitations period of 1 year or less. The Texas statute has a limitations period of 90 days to commence either a civil or administrative proceeding. And then I would note that 3 of those 7 states that create the private cause of action require that the whistleblower report have been to a public body or law enforcement. Bottom line, our analysis of these statutes is that on this record, Mr. Winters would only be allowed to maintain his action for tort damages in one state, and we think that might be in Minnesota. What we would urge the court are 2 conclusions from this analysis. First of all, the legislatures have considered not only the 6 features that we have analyzed on the chart that we have provided to the court, but many others as well. And this is the kind of analysis that ought to be performed by the legislature. And particularly, we would emphasize that Texas has a whistleblower statute. It has some severe limitations that, as Justice Doggett has indicated, Mr. Winters could not meet in this case. We would also direct the court's attention to a decision by the New York Court of Appeals that was cited in one of the amicus briefs. And that case is Murphy versus American Home Products. The citation is 448 Northeast 2nd, 86. The New York Court of Appeals in 1983 in the Murphy case was faced with a precise question before the court today, and that is whether or not to create a public policy exception to employment at will based upon internal financial-oriented whistleblowing. I think the facts of that case were much more egregious. In what we think is a well-reasoned analysis, the court decided that this was better left to the legislature. They were right. A few years later, the New York legislature passed a statute which protects private employees for whistleblowing, but only if the violations concern public health, safety, or general welfare. And the second point that I want to make is that the court ought to place some severe limitations on protecting whistleblowers in the private sector if it is inclined to create a judicial cause of action. And we would suggest that the court follow the reasoning of the case most prominently cited by the petitioner here this morning, Palmer versus Brown from Kansas. The citation on Palmer is 752 Pacific 2nd, 685. 3 important limitations on the cause of action created there. Number 1, the violation must affect public health, safety, welfare. Number 2, there must be clear and convincing evidence that a reasonably prudent person would have thought that the conduct was illegal in the sense of affecting the public health, safety, or welfare. And thirdly, there must have been a good faith concern for the conduct complained of, rather than some corrupt motive like spite, malice, jealousy, or private gain. And I think that the facts of this case would show that there may have been a personal gain involved since there was no public report. We would ask
by a letter or a supplemental brief, put those citations and a summary of them in a supplemental brief.
We would be pleased to direct
a number of copies to the court.
We certainly would. And we would ask the court to affirm the Court of Appeals.
Does the summary that you have provided, is that a summary of statutes and cases that you have cited in your brief or others have cited to the court in this case?
The statutes have been cited?
Yes.
Yes, sir, except for the Missouri statute and the federal statute. And you will find the citation to those statutes at the bottom of the chart.
Assuming that there were agreement with the 6 or 7 elements you have, and focusing in specifically on public health and safety, given the
the broad public interest in economic development in the state. Shouldn't the defrauding of shareholders be a part of the same kind of interest as exposing the public to other types of danger?
Well, perhaps it should be, but I'm not aware that there's anything about Mr. Winter's pleadings in this case that would implicate that the shareholders of Mr. Winter's company were being defrauded in any way.
You say there's only one state where Mr. Winter's might prevail, but aren't there one or possibly two jurisdictions that have generally abolished the employment law doctrine?
And that may be true, and I was referring specifically to the statutes where there's been legislation.
Any other questions? Thank you, counsel.
I'd just like to point out one fact. I received this copy of the 26 state whistleblower statutes. Two aspects of this I'd like to point out. First off, we're not asking the legislature to rule in this matter. We're asking the court to rule. Secondly, I know of at least one state, and why they picked these 26 states, I don't know, but I know of at least one state that I've cited in my brief to, which is Montana, which has a wrongful termination statute, which in effect would cover the cause of action that I'm alleging here today. I would like to have the court review the Palmer versus Brown decision, and also the decision that was rendered by the Arkansas Supreme Court, which is cited to in my brief. Since I don't have it here, it's in Oxford, and I don't recall the remaining portion of it. But in that decision, matter of fact, one moment, let me pull that. Sterling Drug, Inc. versus Oxford. I'd like to point out, in that decision, the court discusses and notes the precise definition of the term public policy as surveyed from other states, found that where the matter strikes at the heart of a citizen's social rights, duties, and responsibilities, a cause of action for wrongful discharge has been allowed. The court went on to state that there is no public policy more basic, nothing more implicit in the concept of ordered liberty than the enforcement of the state's criminal code. Public policy favors the exposure of crime, and the cooperation of citizens possessing knowledge thereof is essential to the effective implementation of that policy. That's specifically what we're asking this court to rule. We're asking you to find that the laws of this state, the United States, which carry criminal penalties, require and encourage our employees to report criminal activity. In order to eradicate criminal activity and deceptive business practices in the workplace. I don't know of a better way of doing that than expressing that in a decision by this court. The fact that criminal activity should not be tolerated in the workplace, that employees who report criminal activity should be protected when they do so, and they do so in good faith. And that's the situation we have here today.
Do you agree with the elements that Mr. Ogden suggests should accompany such a cause of action?
Well,
good faith, promptness in the making the claim, making it in writing, including it to a third party authority, clear criminal violation, followed by immediate retaliation, adverse impact on the public.
I would agree to a certain extent. I think the court should follow the Palmer versus Brown decision. It doesn't necessarily allow the reporting to a third party. I think it needs to be promptly reported. It should be reported either to a third party or to the employer. And in this situation, we have to have the prompt reporting to the employer.
In writing?
No, not in writing.
Good faith?
Enacted in good faith. As I pointed out, what did Mr. Winters have to gain by reporting the fact that there was circulation fraud?
Of a clear criminal violation? You agree with that on me?
Yes, and I believe we have stated a clear criminal violation in this case.
Followed by immediate retaliation?
Well, the immediate retaliation, the retaliation as quickly as is capable by that supervisor, by that individual. In this situation, he was retaliated against almost immediately after reporting these initial acts internally within the company, and within a few months after going outside the circulation department and reporting it to company upper management, to the personnel director.
With an adverse impact on the public?
Yes, and the adverse impact, and I think the court needs to realize the purpose behind, I mean, let's look at who prosecutes crime. It's the state. It's because of the state has a policy that says we're not going to allow this type of activity.
Let's look at the situation of what about the knowledge of the individuals within the Chronicle who are aware of the circulation fraud going on? Seeing that the Chronicle was profiting by it, what type of message does it send to those individuals? That that defrauding advertisers, committing crimes is profitable?
So your disagreement with Mr. Ogden over the elements of such an exception is very limited. You dispute whether or not that exception covers this case or not. That's
certainly
how you see the dispute.
And I think there has to be some distinctions made. I think in Palmer versus Brown, the Kansas Supreme Court, that basically was faced with almost an identical situation as is here. There the allegation was that there was Medicaid fraud going on. The court in that situation, although they had a state statute similar to Texas's, which protected public employees who were whistleblowers, went ahead and created this private action for non-public employees, and also recognized the fact that in that situation they should be able to report the criminal activity simply to their employer. Thank you very much.
So almost all buyers of advertising and newspapers recognize that there's some cut in the circulation figures, and that they really don't pay a lot of attention to that.
Well, I think there was more than just a little puff in the situation.
Any other questions? Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
That concludes the argument and the first pause. The court will take a break for a second.
The audience will please rise.